especially hard time in this country, didn't bear much contemplation. Some of the world's most vicious tortures had been invented in this country, where the value of human life was a far less important thing than in the nation of his origin, Chet reminded himself. China was an ancient land with an ancient culture. But in many ways these people might as well have been Klingons as fellow human beings, so detached were their societal values from what Chester Nomori had grown up with. Well, I really don't have much in the way of religious convictions.
Convictions?
Ming asked. Beliefs, the CIA officer corrected. So, are there any men in your life? A fiancé, perhaps? She sighed.
No, not in some time.
Indeed? I find that surprising, Nomori observed with studied gallantry.
I suppose we are different from Japan, Ming admitted, with just a hint of sadness in her voice.
Nomori lifted the flask and poured some more Mao Tai for both. In that case, he said, with a smile and a raised eyebrow, I offer you a friendly drink.
Thank you, Nomori-san.
My pleasure, Comrade Ming.
He wondered how long it would take.
Perhaps not too long at all. Then the real work would begin. Chapter 7 Developing Leads. It was the sort of coincidence for which police work is known worldwide. Provolov called militia headquarters, and since he was investigating a homicide, he got to speak with the St. Petersburg murder squad leader, a captain. When he said he was looking for some former Spetsnaz soldiers, the captain remembered his morning meeting in which two of his men had reported finding two bodies bearing possible Spetsnaz tattoos, and that was enough to make him forward the call.
Really? The RPG event in Moscow? Yevgeny Petrovich Ustinov asked. Who exactly was killed?
The main target appears to have been Grigory Filipovich Avseenko. He was a pimp, Provolov told his colleague to the north. Also his driver and one of his girls, but they appear to have been inconsequential. He didn't have to elaborate. You didn't use an anti-tank rocket to kill a chauffeur and a whore.
And your sources tell you that two Spetsnaz veterans did the shooting?
Correct. And they flew back to St. Petersburg soon thereafter.
I see. Well, we fished two such people from the River Neva yesterday, both in their late 30s or so, and both shot in the back of the head.
Indeed.
Yes, we have fingerprints from both bodies. We're waiting for Central Army records to match them up. But that will not be very fast.
Let me see what I can do about that, Yevgeny Petrovich. You see, also present at the murder was Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko, and we have concerns that he might have been the true target of the killing.
That would be ambitious, Ustinov observed coolly. Perhaps your friends at Dzerzhinsky Square can get the records morons moving.
I will call them and see, Provolov promised.
Good. Anything else?
Another name, Suvorov. Clementi Ivanich, reportedly a former KGB officer. But that is all I have at the moment. Does the name mean anything to you?
You could hear the man shaking his head over the phone, Provolov noted.
Yet, never heard that one,
the senior detective replied as he wrote it down.
Connection?
My informant thinks he's the man who arranged the killing.
I'll check our records here to see if we have anything on him.
Another former sword and shield man, eh?
How many of those guardians of the state have gone bad?
The St. Petersburg cop asked, rhetorically.
Enough, his colleague in Moscow agreed, with an unseen grimace. This Avseenko fellow, also KGB?
Yes, he reportedly ran the Sparrow School.
Ustinov chuckled at that one. Oh, a state-trained pimp, Marvelous. Good girls?
Lovely, Provolov confirmed. More than we can afford.
A real man doesn't have to pay for it, Oleg Grigorievich, the St. Petersburg cop assured his Moscow colleague.
That is true, my friend. At least not until long afterwards, Provolov added.
That is the truth.
A laugh.
Let me know what you find out.
Yes, I will fax you my notes.
Excellent. I will share my information with you as well, Ustinov promised.
There is a bond among homicide investigators across the world. No country sanctions the private taking of human life. Nation-states reserve such power for themselves alone. In his dreary Moscow office, Lieutenant Provolov made his notes for several minutes. It was too late to call the RVS about rattling the Central Army records cage. First thing in the morning, he promised himself. Then it was time to leave. He picked his coat off the tree next to his desk and headed out to where his official car was parked. This he drove to a corner close to the American Embassy, and a place called Boris Godunov's, a friendly and warm bar. He'd only been there for 5 minutes when a familiar hand touched his shoulder.
"Hello, Mishka," Provolov said without turning.
"You know, Oleg, it's good to see that Russian cops are like American cops."
"It is the same in New York?"
"You bet," Riley confirmed.
"After a long day of chasing bad guys, what's better than a few drinks with your pals?"
The FBI agent waved to the bartender for his usual, a vodka and soda.
"Besides, you get some real work done in a place like this."
"So, anything happening on the pimp case?"
"Yes, the two who did the killing may have shown up dead in St. Petersburg."
Provolov tossed down the last of his straight vodka and filled the American in on the details, concluding,
"What do you make of that?"
"Either it's revenge or insurance, pal. I've seen it happen at home."
"Insurance?"
"Yeah, had it happen in New York. The Mafia took Joey Gallo out, did it in public. And they wanted it to be a signature event, so they got a black hood to do the hit. But then the poor bastard gets shot himself about 15 feet away."
"Insurance, Oleg.
That way the subject can't tell anybody who asked him to take the job. The second shooter just walked away. Never did get a line on him.
Or it could have been a revenge hit. Whoever paid them to do the job whacked them for hitting the wrong target. You pays your money and you takes your choice, pal."
"How do you say, wheels within wheels?"
Riley nodded.
"That's how we say it. Well, at least it gives you some more leads to run down. Maybe your two shooters talked to somebody. Hell, maybe they even kept a diary."
It was like tossing a rock into a pond, Riley thought. The ripples just kept expanding in a case like this. Unlike a nice domestic murder, where a guy whacked his wife for fucking around, or serving dinner late, and then confessed while crying his eyes out at what he'd done. But by the same token, it was an awfully loud crime, and those, more often than not, were the ones you broke because people commented on the noise. And some of those people knew things that you could use. It was just a matter of getting people out on the street, rattling doorknobs and wearing out shoes, until you got what you needed. These Russian cops weren't dumb. They lacked some of the training that Riley took for granted, but for all that, they had the proper cop instincts. And the fact of the matter was that if you followed the proper procedures, you'd break your cases, because the other side wasn't all that smart. The smart ones didn't break the law in so egregious a way. No, the perfect crime was the one you never discovered, the murder victim you never found, the stolen funds missed by bad accounting procedures, the espionage never discovered. Once you knew a crime had been committed, you had a starting place, and it was like unraveling a sweater. There wasn't all that much holding the wool together if you just kept picking at it.
"Tell me, Mishka, how worthy were your mafia adversaries in New York?" Provolov asked after sipping his second drink.
Riley did the same.
It's not like the movies, Oleg. Except maybe Goodfellas. They're cheap hoods. They're not educated. Some of them are pretty damn dumb. Their cachet was that once upon a time they didn't talk. Omerta, they used to call it. The law of silence. I mean, they'd take the fall and never cooperate. But that changed over time. The people from the old country died out and the new generation was softer. And we got tougher. It's a lot easier to laugh your way through 3 years than it is to handle 10. And on top of that, the organization broke down. They stopped taking care of the families while the dad was in the slammer. And that was real bad for morale. So they started talking to us. And we got smarter, too, with electronic surveillance. Now it's called special operations. Back then it was a black bag job. And we weren't always very careful about getting a warrant. I mean, back in the 60s, a mafia don couldn't take a leak without us knowing what color it was.
And they never fought back?
You mean fuck with us? Mess with an FBI agent?
Riley grinned at the very thought.
Oleg, nobody ever messes with the FBI. Back then, and still somewhat to this day, we are the right hand of God himself. And if you mess with us, some really bad things are going to happen. The truth of the matter is that nothing like that has ever happened, but the bad guys worry that it might. The rules get bent some, but no, we never really break them. At least not that I know about. But if you threaten a hood with serious consequences for stepping over the line, chances are he'll take you seriously.
Not here.
They do not respect us that much yet.
Well, then, you have to generate that respect, Oleg.
And it really was about that simple in concept. Though bringing it about, Riley knew, would not be all that easy. Would it take having the local cops go off the reservation once in a while? To show the hoods the price of Les Majestés?
That was part of American history, Riley thought. Town sheriffs like Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and Wild Bill Hickok. Lone Wolf Gonzalez of the Texas Rangers. Bill Tilghman and Billy Three Persons of the U.S. Marshal Service. The cops of their time who didn't so much enforce the law as embody it in the way they walked down the street. There was no corresponding Russian lawman of legend. Maybe they needed one. It was part of the heritage of every American cop. And from watching movies and TV westerns, American citizens grew up with the expectation that breaking the law would bring such a man into your life, and not to your personal profit. The FBI had grown up in an era of increased crime during the Great Depression, and had exploited the existing Western tradition with modern technology and procedures to create its own institutional mystique. To do that had meant convicting a lot of criminals, and killing a few on the street as well. In America, there was the expectation that cops were heroic figures who didn't merely enforce the law, but who protected the innocent as well. There was no such tradition here. Growing it would solve many of the problems in the former Soviet Union, where the lingering tradition was of oppression rather than protection. No John Wayne, no Melvin Purvis in Russian movies, and this nation was the poorer for it. As much as Riley liked working here, and as much as he'd come to like and respect his Russian counterparts, it was much like being dumped into a trash heap with instructions to make it as orderly as Bergdorf Goodman's in New York. All the proper things were there, but organizing them made Hercules' task in the Augean stable seem trivial by comparison. Oleg had the right motivation and the right set of skills, but it was some job he had ahead of him. Riley didn't envy him the task, but he had to help as best he could.
I do not envy you very much, Mishka, but your organization status in your country is something I would like to have.
It didn't just happen, Oleg. It's the product of many years and a lot of good men. Maybe I should show you a Clint Eastwood movie.
Dirty Harry? I have seen it.
Entertaining, the Russian thought, but not overly realistic.
No. Hang 'em high about the Marshal Service, back in the Old West, where men were men and women were grateful. Actually, it's not true in the usual sense. There wasn't much crime in the Old West. That made the Russian look up from his drink in surprise. Then why do all the movies say otherwise? Oleg, movies have to be exciting, and there isn't much exciting about raising wheat or punching cattle. The American West was mainly settled by veterans of our Civil War. That was a hard and cruel conflict. But no man who'd survived the Battle of Shiloh was likely to be intimidated by some bozo on a horse, gun or not. A professor at Oklahoma State University did a book on this subject 20 or so years ago. He checked court records and such, and found out that except for saloon shootings, guns and whiskey make a crummy mix, right? There wasn't a hell of a lot of crime in the West. The citizens could look after themselves, and the laws they had were pretty tough. Not a hell of a lot of repeat offenders. But what it really came down to was that the citizens all had guns and all pretty much knew how to use them. And that is a big deterrent for the bad guys. A cop's less likely to shoot you than an aroused citizen when you get down to it. He doesn't want to do all the paperwork if he can avoid it, right? A sip and a chuckle from the American. In that we are the same, Mishka, Provalov agreed. And, by the way, all this quick-draw stuff in the movies. If it ever happened for real, I've never heard of such a case. No, that's all Hollywood bullshit. You can't draw and fire accurately that way. If you could, they would have trained us to do it that way at Quantico. But except for people who practice for special performances and tournaments and stuff, and that's always at the same angle and the same distance, it just can't be done. You're sure of that? Legends die hard, especially for an otherwise pretty smart cop who had, however, seen his share of westerns. I was a principal instructor in my field division, and damned if I can do it. You are a good shot, eh? Riley nodded with uncharacteristic modesty on this particular issue. Fair, he allowed. Pretty fair. There were less than 300 names on the FBI Academy's possible board, identifying those who'd fired a perfect qualifying course on graduating. Mike Riley was one of them. He'd also been assistant head of the SWAT team in his first field division in Kansas City, before moving over to the chess players in the OC, Organized Crime Department. It made him feel a little naked to walk around without his trusty S&W 1076 automatic. But that was life in the FBI's diplomatic service, the agent told himself. What the hell? The vodka was good here, and he was developing a taste for it. For that, his diplomatic license plates helped. The local cops were pretty serious about giving tickets out. It was a pity they still had so much to learn about major criminal investigations. So our pimp friend was probably the primary target, Oleg? Yes, I think that is likely, but not entirely certain yet. He shrugged. But we'll keep the Golovko angle open. After all, Provalov added, after a long sip of his glass, it will get us lots of powerful cooperation from other agencies. Riley had to laugh at that. Oleg Grigorievich, you know how to handle the bureaucratic part of the job. I couldn't do that better myself. Then he waved to the bartender. He'd spring for the next round. The Internet had to be the best espionage invention ever made, Mary Patricia Foley thought. She also blessed the day that she'd personally recommended Chester Nomori to the Directorate of Operations. That little Nisei had some beautiful moves for an officer still on the short side of 30. He'd done superb work in Japan, and had volunteered in a heartbeat for Operation Genghis in Beijing. His cover job at Nippon Electric Company could hardly have been better suited to the mission requirements, and it seemed that he'd waltzed into his niche like Fred Astaire on a particularly good day. The easiest part of all, it seemed, was getting the data out. 6 years before, CIA had gone to Silicon Valley.
under cover, of course, and commissioned a modern manufacturer to set up a brief production run of a very special modem. In fact, it seemed to many to be a sloppy one, since the link-up time it used was 4 or 5 seconds longer than was the usual. What you couldn't tell was that the last 4 seconds weren't random electronic noise at all, but rather the mating of a special encryption system, which, when caught on a phone tap, sounded just like random noise anyway. So all Chester had to do was set up his message for transmission and punch it through. To be on the safe side, the messages were super encrypted with a 256-bit system specially made at the National Security Agency, and the double encipherment was so complex that even NSA's own bank of supercomputers could only crack it with difficulty and after a lot of expensive time. After that, it was just a matter of setting up a www.something domain through an easily available public vendor and a local ISP, Internet Service Provider, with which the world abounded. It could even be used on a direct call from one computer to another. In fact, that was the original application. And even if the opposition had a hardwire phone tap, it would take a mathematical genius plus the biggest and baddest supercomputer that Sun Microsystems made, even to begin cracking into the message. Lian Ming, Mary Pat read. Secretary to...
To him, eh?
Not a bad potential source. The most charming part of all was that Nomori included the sexual possibilities implicit in the recruitment. The kid was still something of an innocent. He'd probably blushed writing this, the deputy director operations of the Central Intelligence Agency thought to herself. But he'd included it because he was so damned honest in everything he did. It was time to get Nomori a promotion and a raise. Mrs. Foley made the appropriate note on a post-it for attachment to his file. James Bond-san, she thought with an internal chuckle. The easiest part was the reply. Approved. Proceed. She didn't even have to add the with caution part. Nomori knew how to handle himself in the field, which was not always the rule for young field officers. Then she picked up the phone and called her husband on the direct line. "Yeah, honey?" the director of Central Intelligence said. "Busy?" Ed Foley knew that wasn't a question his wife asked lightly. "Not too busy for you, baby. Come on down." And hung up. The CIA director's office is relatively long and narrow, with floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the woods and the special visitor's parking lot. Beyond that are the trees overlooking the Potomac Valley and the George Washington Parkway, and little else. The idea of anyone's having a direct line of sight into any part of this building, much less the office of the director, would have been the cause of serious heartburn for the security pukes. Ed looked up from his paperwork when his wife came in and took the leather chair across from his desk. "Something good?"
"Even better than Eddie's marks at school," she replied with a soft, sexy smile she reserved for her husband alone.
And that had to be pretty good.
Edward Foley Jr. was kicking ass up at Rensselaer Polytechnic in New York, and a starter on their hockey team, which damn near always kicked ass itself in the NCAA. Little Ed might earn a place on the Olympic team, though pro hockey was out. He'd make too much money as a computer engineer to waste his time in so pedestrian a pursuit.
"I think we may have something here."
"Like what, honey?"
"Like the executive secretary to Fang Gan," she replied. "Nomori's trying to recruit her, and he says the prospects are good."
"Genghis," Ed observed. They ought to have picked a different name, but unlike most CIA operations, the name for this one hadn't been generated by a computer in the basement. The fact of the matter was that this security measure hadn't been applied for the simple reason that nobody had ever expected anything to come of it. CIA had never gotten any kind of agent into the PRC government, at least not above the rank of captain in the People's Liberation Army.
The problems were the usual ones. First, they had to recruit an ethnic Chinese, and CIA hadn't had much success at that. Next, the officer in question had to have perfect language skills and the ability to disappear into the culture. For a variety of reasons, none of that had ever happened. Then Mary Pat had suggested trying Nomuri. His corporation did a lot of business in China, after all, and the kid did have good instincts. And so Ed Foley had signed off on it, not really expecting much to result. But again, his wife's field instincts had proven superior to his. It was widely believed that Mary Pat Foley was the best field officer the agency had had in 20 years, and it looked as if she was determined to prove that. How exposed is Chet? His wife had to nod her concern at that one. He's hanging out there, but he knows how to be careful, and his communications gear is the best we have. Unless they brute-force him, you know, just pick him up because they don't like his haircut, he ought to be pretty safe. Anyway, she handed over the communication from Beijing. The DCI read it 3 times before handing it back. Well, if he wants to get laid, it's not good field craft, honey. Not good to get that involved with your agent. I know that, Ed, but you play the cards you're dealt, remember? And if we get her a computer like the one Chet's using, her security won't be all that bad either, will it? Unless they have somebody pick it apart, Ed Foley thought aloud. Oh, Jesus, Ed, our best people would have a cast-iron motherfucker of a time figuring it all out. I ran that project myself, remember? It's safe. Easy, honey. The DCI held up his hand. When Mary used that sort of language, she was really into the matter at hand. Yeah, I know, it's secure, but I'm the worrier and you're the cowgirl, remember? Okay, honey bunny. The usual sweet smile that went with seduction and getting her way. You've already told him to proceed? He's my officer, Eddie. A resigned nod. It wasn't fair that he had to work with his wife here. He rarely won any arguments at the office either. Okay, baby, it's your operation. Run with it. But what? But we change Genghis to something else. If this one pans out, then we go to a monthly name cycle. This one has some serious implications, and we've got to go max security on it. She had to agree with that. As case officers, the two of them had run an agent known in CIA legend as Cardinal, Colonel Mikhail Semyonovich Filitov, who'd worked inside the Kremlin for more than 30 years, feeding gold-plated information on every aspect of the Soviet military, plus some hugely valuable political intelligence. For bureaucratic reasons lost in the mists of time, Cardinal had not been handled as a regular agent in place, and that had saved him from Aldrich Ames and his treacherous betrayal of a dozen Soviet citizens who'd worked for America. For Ames, it had worked out to roughly $100,000 per life given away. Both of the Foleys regretted the fact that Ames was allowed to live, but they weren't in the law enforcement business. Okay, Eddie, monthly change cycle. You're always so careful, honey. You call or me? We'll wait until she gives us something useful before going to all the trouble. But let's change Genghis to something else. It's too obviously a reference to China. Okay. An impish smile. How about Zorga for the moment? She suggested. The name was that of Richard Zorga, one of the greatest spies who'd ever lived, a German national who'd worked for the Soviets, and, just possibly, the man who'd kept Hitler from winning his Eastern Front war with Stalin. The Soviet dictator, knowing this, hadn't lifted a hand to save him from execution. Gratitude, Yosef Vissarionovich had once said, is a disease of dogs. The DCI nodded. His wife had a lively sense of humor, especially as applied to business matters. When do you suppose we'll know if she'll play ball with us? About as soon as Chet gets his rocks off, I suppose. Mary, did you ever...
In the field?
Ed, that's a guy thing, not a girl thing, she told her husband with a sparkling grin as she lifted her papers and headed back out. Except with you, honey bunny. The Alitalia DC-10 touched down about 15 minutes early due to the favorable winds. Renato Cardinal Di Milo was pleased enough to think through an appropriate prayer of thanksgiving. A longtime member of the Vatican's diplomatic service, he was accustomed to long flights, but that wasn't quite the same as enjoying them. He wore his red, cardinal, and black suit that was actually more akin to an official uniform, and not a conspicuously comfortable one at that, despite the custom tailoring that came from one of Rome's better shops. One of the drawbacks to his clerical and diplomatic status was that he'd been unable to shed his suit coat for the flight. But he'd been able to kick off his shoes, only to find that his feet had swollen on the flight, and getting them back on was more difficult than usual. That evoked a sigh rather than a curse as the plane taxied to the terminal. The senior flight attendant ushered him to the forward door and allowed him to leave the aircraft first. One advantage to his diplomatic status was that all he ever had to do was wave his diplomatic passport at the control officers, and in this case a senior PRC government official was there to greet him at the end of the jetway.
"Welcome to our country," the official said, extending his hand.
"It is my pleasure to be here," the cardinal replied, noting that this communist atheist didn't kiss his ring, as was the usual protocol. Well, Catholicism in particular, and Christianity in general, were not exactly welcome in the People's Republic of China, were they? But if the PRC expected to live in the civilized world, then they'd have to accept representation with the Holy See. And that was that. And besides, he'd go to work on these people. And who knew, maybe he could convert one or two. Stranger things had happened. And the Roman Catholic Church had handled more formidable enemies than this one. With a wave and a small escort group, the demi-minister conducted his distinguished visitor through the concourse toward the place where the official car and escort waited.
"How was your flight?" the underling asked.
"Lengthy, but not unpleasant," was the expected reply. Diplomats had to act as though they loved flying, though even the flight crews found journeys of this length tiresome. It was his job to observe the new ambassador of the Vatican, to see how he acted, how he looked out the car's windows even, which in this case was not unlike all the other first-time diplomats who came to Beijing. They looked out at the differences. The shapes of the buildings were new and different to them, the color of the bricks, and how the brickwork looked close up and at a distance. The way in which things that were essentially the same became fascinating because of differences that were actually microscopic when viewed objectively. It took a total of 28 minutes to arrive at the residence/embassy. It was an old building, dating back to the turn of the previous century, and had been the largest home of an American Methodist missionary. Evidently one who liked his American comforts, the official thought, and had passed through several incarnations, including, he'd learned the previous day, that of a bordello in the diplomatic quarter in the 1920s and 30s, because diplomats liked their comforts as well. Ethnic Chinese, he wondered, or Russian women who'd always claimed to be of the Tsarist nobility, or so he'd heard. After all, Westerners enjoyed fucking noble women for some reason or other, as if their body parts were different somehow. He'd heard that one, too, at the office, from one of the archivists who kept track of such things at the ministry. Chairman Mao's personal habits were not recorded, but his lifelong love for deflowering 12-year-olds was well known in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Every national leader had something odd and distasteful about him, the young official knew. Great men had great aberrations.
The car pulled up to the old wooden frame house, where a uniformed policeman opened the door for the visiting Italian, and even saluted, earning himself a nod from the man wearing the ruby-red skullcap. Waiting on the porch was yet another foreigner, Monsignor Franz Schepke, whose diplomatic status was that of DCM, or Deputy Chief of Mission, which usually meant the person who was really in charge of things while the ambassador, mainly a man chosen for political reasons, reigned in the main office. They didn't know if that were the case here yet. Schepke looked as German as his ancestry was, tall and spare with gray-blue eyes that revealed nothing at all, and a wonderful language gift that had mastered not only the complex Chinese language, but also the local dialect and accent as well. Over the phone, this foreigner could pass for a party member, much to the surprise of local officials who were not in the least accustomed to foreigners who could even speak the language properly, much less master it. The German national, the Chinese official saw, kissed his superior's ring. Then the Italian shook his hand and embraced the younger churchman. They probably knew each other. Cardinal de Milo then led Schepke to the escort and introduced them. They'd met many times before, of course, and that made the senior churchman appear just a little backward to the local official. In due course, the luggage was loaded into the residence-slash-embassy building, and the Chinese official got back in the official car for the ride to the foreign ministry, where he'd make his contact report. The papal nuncio was past his prime, he'd write. A pleasant enough old chap, perhaps, but no great intellect. A fairly typical Western ambassador, in other words. No sooner had they gotten inside than Schepke tapped his right ear and gestured around the building.
Everywhere? The cardinal asked.
Ja, doch, Monsignor Schepke replied in his native German, then shifted to Greek. Not modern, but Attic Greek, that spoken by Aristotle, similar to but different from the modern version of that language, a language perpetuated only by a handful of scholars at Oxford and a few more Western universities.
Welcome, Eminence. Even airplanes can take too long. Why can we not travel by ship? It would be a much gentler way of getting from point to point.
The curse of progress, the German priest offered weakly.
The Rome-Beijing flight was only 40 minutes longer than the one between Rome and New York, after all, but Renato was a man from a different and more patient age.
My escort, what can you tell me of him?
His name is Kian. He's 40, married, one son. He will be our point of contact with the foreign ministry. Bright, well-educated, but a dedicated communist. Son of another such man, Schepke said, speaking rapidly in the language learned long before in seminary.
He and his boss knew that this exchange would probably be recorded, and would then drive linguists in the foreign ministry to madness. Well, it was not their fault that such people were illiterate, was it?
And the building is fully wired, then? De Milo asked, heading over to a tray with a bottle of red wine on it.
We must assume so, Schepke confirmed with a nod, while the cardinal poured a glass.
I could have the building swept, but finding reliable people here is not easy,
and those able to do a proper sweep would then use the opportunity to plant their own bugs for whatever country they worked for. America, Britain, France, Israel, all were interested in what the Vatican knew. The Vatican, located in central Rome, is technically an independent country. Hence Cardinal de Milo's diplomatic status, even in a country where religious convictions were frowned upon at best, and stamped into the earth at worst. Renato Cardinal de Milo had been a priest for just over 40 years, most of which time had been spent in the Vatican's foreign service. His language skills were not unknown within the confines of his own service, but rare even there, and damned rare in the outside world, where men and women took a great deal of time to learn languages. But de Milo picked them up easily, so much so that it surprised him that others were unable to do so as well. In addition to being a priest, in addition to being a diplomat, DeMillo was also an intelligence officer. All ambassadors were supposed to be, but he was much more so than most. One of his jobs was to keep the Vatican, therefore the Pope, informed of what was happening in the world, so that the Vatican, therefore the Pope, could take action, or at least use influence in the proper direction. DeMillo knew the current Pope quite well. They'd been friends for years before his election to the chair of the Pontifex Maximus. Maximus, in this context, meaning chief, and Pontifex meaning bridge-builder, as a cleric was supposed to be the bridge between men and their God. DeMillo had served the Vatican in this capacity in 7 countries. Before the fall of the Soviet Union, he'd specialized in Eastern European countries, where he'd learned to debate the merits of communism with its strongest adherents, mostly to their discomfort and his own amusement. Here would be different, the cardinal thought. It wasn't just the Marxist beliefs. This was a very different culture. Confucius had defined the place of a Chinese citizen 2 millennia before, and that place was different from what Western culture taught. There was a place for the teachings of Christ here, of course, as there was everywhere. But the local soil was not as fertile for Christianity as it was elsewhere. Local citizens who sought out Christian missionaries would do so out of curiosity, and, once exposed to the gospel, would find Christian beliefs more curious still, since they were so different from the nation's more ancient teachings. Even the more normal beliefs that were in keeping, more or less, with Chinese traditions, like the Eastern spiritualist movement, known as Falun Gong, had been ruthlessly, if not viciously, repressed. Cardinal DeMillo told himself that he'd come to one of the few remaining pagan nations, and one in which martyrdom was still a possibility for the lucky or luckless, depending on one's point of view. He sipped his wine, trying to decide what time his body thought it was, as opposed to what time it was by his watch. In either case, the wine tasted good, reminding him, as it did, of his home, a place which he'd never truly left, even in Moscow or Prague. Beijing, though, Beijing might be a challenge. Chapter 8 Underlings and Underthings. It wasn't the first time he'd done this. It was exciting in its way, and arousing, and marginally dangerous because of the time and place. Mainly it was an exercise in effective memory and the discerning eye. The hardest part was converting the English units to metric. The perfect female form was supposed to be 36-24-36, not 91.44, 60.96, 91.44. The last time he'd been in a place like this had been in the Beverly Center Mall in Los Angeles, buying for Maria Castillo, a voluptuous Latina who'd been delighted at his error, taking her waist for 24 rather than its true 27. You wanted to err on the low side in numbers, but probably the big side in letters. If you took a 36B chest to be a 34C, she wouldn't be mad. But if you took a 24-inch waist for a 28-inch, she'd probably be pissed. Stress, Nomori told himself with a shake of the head, came in many shapes and sizes. He wanted to get this right because he wanted Ming as a source. But he wanted her as a mistress, too. And that was one more reason not to make a mistake. The color was the easy part. Red. Of course, red. This was still a country in which red was the good color, which was convenient because red had always been the lively choice in women's underthings, the color of adventure and giggles and looseness. And looseness served both his biological and professional purposes. He had other things to figure out, too. Ming was not tall, scarcely 5 feet.
151 centimeters or so, Nomori thought, doing the conversion in his head. She was short, but not really petite. There was no real obesity in China. People didn't overeat here, probably because of the lingering memory of times when food had not been in abundance, and overeating was simply not possible. Ming would have been considered overweight in California, Chester thought, but that was just her body type. She was squat because she was short, and no amount of dieting or working out or makeup could change it. Her waist wouldn't be much less than 27 inches. For her chest, 34B was about the best he could hope for. Well, maybe 34C. No, he decided, B-plus at most. So a 34B bra and medium shorts, panties, red silk, something feminine. Something on the wild, whorish side of feminine. Something that she could look into the mirror alone with and giggle. And maybe sigh at how different she looked wearing such things. And maybe smile. That special inward smile women had for such moments. The moment when you knew you had them. And the rest was just dessert. The best part of Victoria's Secret was the catalog, designed for men who really and sensibly wanted to buy the models themselves, despite the facial attitudes that sometimes made them look like lesbians on Quaaludes. But with such bodies, a man couldn't have everything, could he? Fantasies. Things of the mind. Nomori wondered if the models really existed or were the products of computers. They could do anything with computers these days. Make Rosie O'Donnell into Twiggy. Or Cindy Crawford obsolete. Back to work, he told himself. This might be a place for fantasies, but not that one. Not yet. Okay, it had to be sexy. It had to be something that would both amuse and excite Ming, and himself, too. That was all part of it. Nomori took the catalog off the pile because it was a lot easier for him to see what he wanted in a filled rather than an unfilled condition. He turned pages and stopped dead on page 26. There was a black girl modeling it, and whatever genetic stew she'd come from must have had some fine ingredients, as her face would have appealed to a member of Hitler's SS just as much as Idi Amin. It was that sort of face. Better yet, she wore something called a racerback bra with matching string bikini panties, and the color was just perfect. A red-purple that the Romans had once called Tyrian scarlet. The color on the toga stripe of members of the senatorial order. Reserved by price and custom to the richest of the Roman nobility, not quite red, not quite purple. The bra material was satin and lycra, and it closed in front, the easier for a girl to put it on, and the more interesting for a guy to take it off, his mind thought, as he headed over to the proper rack of clothing. 34B, he thought. If too small, it would be all the more flattering. Small or medium on the string bikini. Shit, he decided. Get one of each. Just to be sure, he also got a no-wire triangle pattern bra and thong panties in an orange-red color that the Catholic Church would call a mortal sin just for looking at. On impulse, he got several additional panties on the assumption that they soiled more quickly than bras did. Something he wasn't sure of, despite being a field intelligence officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. They didn't tell you about such things at the farm. He'd have to do a memo on that. It might give MP a chuckle in her seventh-floor office at Langley. One other thing, he thought, perfume. Women liked perfume. You'd expect them to like it, especially here. The entire city of Beijing smelled like a steel mill, lots of coal dust and other pollutants in the air, as Pittsburgh had probably been at the turn of the last century. And the sad truth was that the Chinese didn't bathe as diligently as Californians did, and nowhere nearly as regularly as the Japanese. So, something that smelled nice. Dream angels, the brand was called.
It came in a perfume spray, lotion, and other applications that he didn't understand. But he was sure Ming would, since she was a girl, and this was a quintessential girl thing. So he bought some of that, too, using his NEC credit card to pay for it. His Japanese bosses would understand. There were skillfully arranged and choreographed sex tours that took Japanese salarymen to various places in Asia that catered to the sex trade. That was probably how AIDS had gotten to Japan, and why Nomura used a condom for everything there except urinating. The total came to about 300 euros. The sales clerk wrapped everything and commented that the lady in his life was very lucky.
"She will be," Nomura promised himself. The underthings he'd just bought her, well, the fabrics felt as smooth as flexible glass, and the colors would arouse a blind man. The only question was how they would affect a dumpy Chinese female secretary to a government minister. It wasn't as though he was trying to seduce Suzy Wong. Lian Ming was pretty ordinary rather than ordinarily pretty. But you never knew. Amy Irvin, his first conquest at the ripe old age of 17 years and 3 months, had been pretty enough to inspire him, which meant, for a boy of that age, she had the requisite body parts, no beard like a Civil War general, and had showered in the previous month. At least Ming wouldn't be like so many American women now who'd visited the plastic surgeon to have their tummies tucked, tits augmented to look like cereal bowls, and lips pumped full of chemicals until they looked like some strange kind of two-part fruit. What women did to attract men, and what men did in the hope of seducing them. What a potential energy source, Nomura thought, as he turned the key in his company Nissan.
"What is it today, Ben?" Ryan asked his national security advisor.
"CIA is trying to get a new operation underway in Beijing. For the moment, it's called Zorga."
"As in Richard Zorga?"
"Correct."
"Somebody must be ambitious."
"Okay, tell me about it." "There's an officer named Chester Nomura, an illegal. He's in Beijing, covered as a computer salesman for NEC. He's trying to make a move on a secretary, female, for a senior PRC minister, a guy named Fang Gan."
"Who is?" Ryan asked over his coffee mug.
"Sort of a minister without portfolio. Works with the premier and the foreign minister."
"Like that Zhang Hansan guy?"
"Not a senior, but yes. Looks like a very high-level gopher type. Has contacts in their military and foreign ministries. Good ideological credentials, sounding board for others in their Politburo. Anyway, Nomura is trying to make a move on the girl."
"Bond," Ryan observed in a studiously neutral voice. "James Bond."
"I know Nomura's name. He did some good work for us in Japan when I had your job. This is for information only, not my approval."
"Correct, Mr. President. Mrs. Foley is running this one, and wanted to give you a heads up."
"Okay, tell MP that I'm interested in whatever take comes out of this." Ryan fought off the grimace that came from learning of another person's private, well, if not private, then his sex life.
"Yes, sir."
Chapter 9 Initial Results. Chester Nomura had learned many things in his life, from his parents and his teachers and his instructors at the farm. But one lesson he'd yet to learn was the value of patience, at least as it applied to his personal life. That didn't keep him from being cautious, however. That was why he'd sent his plans to Langley. It was embarrassing to have to inform a woman of his proposed sex life. MP was a brilliant field spook, but she still took her leaks sitting down, Nomura reminded himself. But he didn't want the agency to think that he was an alley cat on the government payroll. Because the truth was, he liked his job. The excitement was at least as addictive as the cocaine that some of his college chums had played with. Maybe that's why Mrs. Foley liked him, Nomura speculated. They were of a kind.
Mary Pat, they said in the Directorate of Operations, was the cowgirl. She'd swaggered through the streets of Moscow during the last days of the Cold War like Annie fucking Oakley packing heat. And though she'd been burned by KGB's second chief directorate, she hadn't given the fuckers anything. And whatever operation she'd run, this was still very, very secret, it must have been a son of a bitch, because she'd never gone back in the field but had scampered up the CIA career ladder like a hungry squirrel up an oak tree. The president thought she was smart, and if you wanted a friend in this business, the president of the United States was right up there, because he knew the spook business. Then came the stories about what President Ryan had once done. Bringing out the chairman of the fucking KGB? MP must have been part of that, the boys and girls of the DO all thought. All they knew, even within the confines of CIA, except, of course, for those who needed to know, both of them, the saying went, was what had been published in the press. And while the media generally knew jack shit about black operations, a CNN TV crew had put a camera in the face of a former KGB chairman now living in Winchester, Virginia. While he hadn't spilled many beans, the face of a man the Soviet government had declared dead in a plane crash was bean enough to make a very rich soup indeed. Nomori figured he was working for a couple of real pros, and so he let them know what he was up to, even if that meant causing a possible blush for Mary Patricia Foley, Deputy Director, Operations, of the Central Intelligence Agency. He'd picked a Western-style restaurant. There were more than a few of them in Beijing now, catering both to the locals and to tourists who felt nostalgic for the taste of home, or who worried about their GI systems over here. Not unreasonably, Nomori thought. The quality wasn't anything close to a real American restaurant, but it was considerably more appealing than the deep-fried rat he suspected was on the menu of many Beijing eateries. He'd arrived first and was relaxing with a cheap American bourbon when Ming came through the door. Nomori waved in what he hoped was not an overly boyish way. She saw him do so, and her resulting smile was just about right, he thought. Ming was glad to see him, and that was step one in the plan for the evening. She made her way to his corner table in the back. He stood, showing a degree of gentlemanliness unusual in China, where women were nowhere near as valued as they were back home. Nomori wondered if that would change, if all the killing of female babies could suddenly make Ming a valuable commodity, despite her plainness. He still couldn't get over the casual killing of children. He kept it in the front of his mind, just to keep clear who the good guys were in the world, and who the bad guys were. "It's so good to see you," he said with an engaging smile. "I was worried you might not meet me here."
"Oh, really? Why?"
"Well, your superior at work. I'm sure that he, well, needs you, I suppose is the polite way to put it," Nomori said with a hesitant voice, delivering his rehearsed line pretty well, he thought. He had. The girl giggled a little.
"Comrade Fang is over 65, she said. "He is a good man, a good superior, and a fine minister, but he works long hours and he is no longer a young man."
"Okay, so he fucked you, but not all that much," Nomori interpreted that to mean. "And maybe you'd like a little more from somebody closer to your age, eh?" Of course, if Fang was over 65 and still getting it on, then maybe he is worthy of some respect, Nomori added to himself, then tossed the thought aside. "Have you eaten here before?" The place was called Vincenzo's, and pretended to be Italian. In fact, the owner-operator was a half-breed Italian-Chinese from Vancouver, who spoke an Italian would have gotten him hit by the mafia had he tried it in Palermo, or even Mulberry Street in Manhattan. But here in Beijing it seemed genuinely ethnic enough.
"No,"
Ming replied, looking around at, to her, this most exotic of locations. Every table had an old wine bottle, its bottom wrapped in twine, and an old drippy red candle at the top. The tablecloth was checked white and red. Whoever had decorated this place had evidently seen too many old movies. That said, it didn't look anything like a local restaurant, even with the Chinese servers. Dark wood paneling, hooks near the door for hanging coats. It could have been in any East Coast city in America, where it would have been recognized as one of those old family Italian places, a mom-and-pop joint with good food and little flash.
What is Italian food like?
At its best, Italian cooking is among the very finest in the world, Nomori answered. You've never had Italian food? Never at all? Then may I select for you? Her response was girlish in its charm. Women were all the same. Treat them in the right way, and they turn into wax in your hand, to be kneaded and shaped to your will. Nomori was starting to like this part of the job, and some day it might be useful in his personal life, too. He waved to the waiter, who came over with a subservient smile. Nomori, first of all, ordered a genuine Italian white wine. Strangely, the wine list here was actually first-rate, and quite pricey to boot, of course. And, with a deep breath, fettuccine Alfredo, quintessential Italian heart attack food. From looking at Ming, he figured that she'd not refuse rich food. So the new computer and printer systems continue to work out?
Yes, and Minister Fang has praised me before the rest of the staff for choosing it. You have made me something of a hero, Comrade Nomori.
I am pleased to hear that, the CIA officer replied, wondering if being called comrade was a good thing for the current mission or a bad one. We are bringing out a new portable computer now, one you could take home with you, but which has the same power as your office mainframe, with all the same features and software, of course, even a modem for accessing the Internet.
Really? I get to do that so seldom. At work, you see, it is not encouraged for us to surf the net, except when the minister wants something specific.
Is that so? What net interests does Minister Fang have?
Mainly political commentary, and mainly in America and Europe. Every morning I print up various pieces from the newspapers, the Times of London, New York Times, Washington Post, and so on. The minister especially likes to see what the Americans are thinking.
Not very much, Nomori observed as the wine arrived.
Excuse me?
Ming asked, getting him to turn back.
Hm?
Oh, the Americans, they don't think very much. The shallowest people I have ever encountered. Loud, poorly educated, and they're women. Chet let his voice trail off.
What of their women, Comrade Nomori? Ming asked,
virtually on command.
Ah.
He took a sip of the wine and nodded for the waiter to serve it properly. It was a pretty good one from Tuscany. Have you ever seen the American toy, the Barbie doll?
Yes, they are made here in China, aren't they?
That is what every American woman wishes to be. Hugely tall, with massive bosoms, a waist you can put your hands around. That is not a woman. It's a toy, a mannequin for children to play with. And about as intelligent as your average American woman. Do you think they have language skills as you do? Consider, we now converse in English. A language native to neither of us, but we converse well, do we not?
Yes,
Ming agreed. How many Americans speak Mandarin, do you suppose? Or Japanese? No, Americans have no education, no sophistication. They are a backward nation, and their women are very backward. They even go to surgeons to have their bosoms made bigger, like that stupid child's doll. It's comical to see them. Especially to see them nude, he concluded with a dangle.
You have?
She asked, on cue.
Have what?
You mean seen American women nude?
He got a welcome nod for his question. This was going well.
Yes, Ming, I am a man of the world.
Yes, I have. I lived there for some months, and it was interesting in a grotesque sort of way. Some of them can be very sweet, but not like a decent Asian woman with proper proportions, and womanly hair that doesn't come from some cosmetics bottle. And manners. Americans lack the manners of an Asian.
But there are many of our people over there.
Didn't you meet one?
No, the Round Eyes keep them for themselves. I suppose their men appreciate real women, even while their own women turn into something else.
He reached to pour some more wine into Ming's glass.
But in fairness, there are some things Americans are good at.
Such as? She asked.
The wine was already loosening her tongue. I will show you later. Perhaps I owe you an apology, but I have taken the liberty of buying you some American things.
Really?
Excitement in her eyes. This was really going well, Nomori told himself. He'd have to go easier on the wine. Well, half a bottle, two of these glasses wouldn't hurt him in any way. How did that song go? It's okay to do it on the first date. Well, he didn't have to worry about much in the way of religious convictions or inhibitions here, did he? That was one advantage to communism, wasn't it? The fettuccine arrived right on time, and surprisingly it was pretty good. He watched her eyes as she took her first forkful. Vincenzo's used silverware instead of chopsticks, which was a better idea for fettuccine Alfredo anyway. Her dark eyes were wide as the noodles entered her mouth.
This is fine. Lots of eggs have gone into it. I love eggs, she confided.
They're your arteries, honey, the case officer thought. He watched her inhale the first bit of the fettuccine. Nomori reached across the table to top off her wine glass once more. She scarcely noticed. She attacked her pasta so furiously. Halfway through the plate of pasta, she looked up.
"I have never had so fine a dinner," Ming told him.
Nomori responded with a warm grin. "I am so pleased that you are enjoying yourself."
"Wait till you see the drawers I just got you, honey."
Attention to orders!
Major General Marion Diggs wondered what his new command would bring him. The second star on his shoulder, well, he told himself that he could feel the additional weight, but the truth was that he couldn't, not really. His last 5 years in the uniform of his country had been interesting. The first commander of the reconstituted 10th Armored Cavalry Regiment, the Buffalo Soldiers, he'd made that ancient and honored regiment into the drillmasters of the Israeli Army, turning the Negev Desert into another national training center. And in 2 years he'd hammered every Israeli brigade commander into the ground, then built them up again, tripling their combat effectiveness by every quantifiable measure. So that now the Israeli troopers' swagger was actually justified by their skills. Then he'd gone off to the real NTC in the high California desert, where he'd done the same thing for his own United States Army. He'd been there when the bio war had begun, with his own 11th ACR, the famous Black Horse Cavalry, and a brigade of National Guardsmen, whose unexpected use of advanced battlefield control equipment had surprised the hell out of the Black Horse and their proud commander, Colonel Al Ham. The whole bunch had deployed to Saudi, along with the 10th from Israel, and together they'd given a world-class bloody nose to the army of the short-lived United Islamic Republic. After acing his colonel command, he'd really distinguished himself